right. Hi, everyone. I'm Kendrick. I'm going to give sort of a status report on Primordial Non-Gaussianity. And I'm mostly going to talk about data analysis, but I want to start by just reviewing the theory a bit. The analysis papers tend to have the flavor of enumerating long lists of parameters and giving constraints on them. So I just want to give some context into what signals we look for and why we look for them. As everyone here probably knows, if we start with a simple model of inflation, single field slow roll inflation on a nearly flat potential, and we start with all modes of the inflaton field phi in their ground state, the so-called Bunch-Davies vacuum, then K modes are excited when they cross the horizon, when their wavelength is equal to the co-moving horizon. And at the end of inflation, we get an excited field whose power spectrum is nearly scale invariant, with the possibility of a small deviation from scale invariance, which is what we need to be consistent with cosmological data. So it's been shown that in this model, to an excellent approximation, the curvature perturbation at the end of inflation is Gaussian. Throughout this talk, I'm not going to consider isocurvature modes, so I'm just going to parameterize the initial conditions of the universe by the adiabatic curvature zeta. So this calculation assumes that no other fields are involved in setting the adiabatic curvature perturbation, a standard kinetic term, and no self-interactions of the unphoton beyond those that are hidden in the potential V of phi. So if we mutate these assumptions, we can generate non-Gaussian initial conditions. And so searching for non-Gaussianity in the CMB, say, or indirectly in the adiabatic curvature zeta, is a probe of early universe physics. So I want to just give some models, and I'm not going to be too encyclopedic. I think it's more useful to give a few representative examples. To start out, the absolute simplest model, in my view, is the absolute simplest model generating non-Gaussian initial conditions is a modulated reheating model. So suppose that there's some auxiliary field sigma, which gets perturbations during inflation, and then the field value of sigma controls the decay rate of the inflaton to the standard model. So this mechanism on its own would generate an adiabatic curvature perturbation. So even if we just ignore fluctuations in the inflaton field itself, if we have fluctuations in its decay rate generated by the usual quantum mechanical mechanism, then we get an adiabatic curvature perturbation. And in general, the adiabatic curvature perturbation zeta is just some nonlinear function of sigma that we can write as a general Taylor series. So if sigma is a Gaussian field by the usual mechanism, then if I just change variables in the second line, if I call the combination A times delta sigma zeta g, then we can write the adiabatic curvature perturbation in this model as some lowest order approximation zeta g plus a term proportional to zeta g squared whose coefficient is a free parameter. So this equation defines the parameter f and l local. The signal here is more general than the model which motivated it. The same type of non-Gaussian curvature perturbation arises in many models with multiple fields, for example, the curviton model, where a spectator field during inflation eventually generates the adiabatic curvature perturbation. I want to distinguish between local and non-local non-Gaussianity. So when I say local non-Gaussianity, I mean the model with these three parameters, f and l, which I just described, and new parameters g and l and tau and l. So g and l is easy. G and l is just adding a multiple of zeta Gaussian cubed to a Gaussian adiabatic curvature perturbation zeta g. I should say that when we search for these signals in data, the lowest order correlation function of zeta, which is sensitive to f and l, was the three-point function. And if you work out, it's easy to work out the three-point function in the f and l model here in the second line. And if you forecast the signal to noise for this three-point function, if you imagine an observer that can see all the modes of zeta in a 3D box, then if you put in all the correct phase space factors and so on, then you find that the signal to noise comes mainly from configurations of k's, which if we represent them as a closed triangle, one of the k's is much smaller than the other two. So we're looking for three-way correlations between one long wavelength mode and two small-scale modes. And analogously, in the GNL model, there's no three-point function because there's a zeta to minus zeta symmetry. The lowest order correlation function, which is sensitive to GNL type non-Gaussianity, is the four-point function. And it turns out that the signal to noise comes from a similar type of configuration where one of the k's in the four-point function is small compared to the others. So this special limit of an endpoint function I'll refer to as squeezed. So that's FNL and GNL. To complete local non-Gaussianity, I need to tell you about one more parameter, tau NL, which is a little more awkward to describe, but it works like this. If we go back to the FNL model and work out the three-point function and four-point function, then we can generalize by just allowing their coefficients. In the FNL model, those coefficients are not independent parameters, but we could generalize by allowing the coefficient of the four-point function to call it tau NL and let it be independent of the three-point function. So that's the definition of tau NL. And just as an example to show that these can generally be independent, if I take two scale invariant Gaussian fields, zeta and phi, zeta g and phi g, and then define a non-Gaussian curvature perturbation zeta by zeta g plus epsilon zeta g phi g, in this model, FNL would be zero and tau NL would be epsilon squared. Tau NL, by definition, shows up in the four-point function. And if you ask where its signal-to-noise comes from, it comes from so-called collapsed quadrilaterals, where none of the k's is individually small, but the vector sum of two of the k's is small compared to any of the k's in the quadrilateral. So this type of endpoint function where none of the k's is individually small, but some vector sum is, I'll refer to as collapsed throughout the talk. Okay, so that's local non-Gaussianity. Non-local non-Gaussianity, I'll describe next. So I first just want to give one example, which is DBI inflation. So this is a very influential, I think from 2004, string-motivated model of inflation, where the inflaton is the distance between two brains that Coulomb attract. And the effective action of this inflaton phi has the form shown in the first equation with the DBI kinetic term, the square root kinetic term. So after a magic change of variables, you can write this. Idea behind this model is that inflation can happen on a flat potential because the square root, if you work out the equations of motion, they don't allow the square root in the kinetic term to become negative. And so that sets a speed limit on how fast the inflaton can travel, such that inflation can last for many E-foldings on a steep potential because the inflaton can't just can't exceed a speed limit and roll all the way to the bottom in a few E-foldings. All right. So there's a magic change of variables here. The technical idea is replacing this scalar field phi by the Goldstone boson pi associated with the spontaneously broken time translation, which allows the action to be put in the form shown in the last line. One can recognize this action as the usual minimally coupled scalar in a near de Sitter metric, plus a small interaction term whose coefficient f is a free parameter proportional to sigma dot cubed. So that sigma dot cubed interaction is what generates non-Gaussianity in this model. When it's easy to work to see how it works in this change of variables. So if we just do perturbative QFT, if we suppose that f is not too large, then we have a quadratic action whose mode functions we can solve exactly. The three-point function, this cubic interaction generates a three-point correlation that can be worked out just by doing perturbative QFT. The three-point function is an integral over the conformal time when the interaction happens. That integral is easy to do, and one gets the three-point function shown in the last equation in the slide here. If we do this, the same sort of signal-to-noise forecast where we put zeta in a box, consider an observer that can see all 3D modes in this box and is estimating the coefficient f, then it turns out that most of the signal-to-noise comes from equilateral triangles, measuring the three-point function in equilateral triangles. And so the cosmologist terminology for this parameter f is FNL equilateral. Okay? So this brings us, that's one example of a non-local non-Gaussianity. This brings us to the effective field theory of inflation, where one just writes down the most general set of interaction terms, starting with a standard kinetic term, writes down the most general set of interaction terms that's consistent with the relevant symmetries. In this case, the relevant symmetry is the approximate time translation that allows inflation to last for many e-foldings. And of course, physicists are experts at, if you give them a quadratic Lagrangian, thinking up, inventing new interaction terms that one can add, interesting interaction terms. So just to enumerate a few possibilities, on the first line, I have the pi dot cube term that arises is fairly generic in this type of setup and arises in dBi inflation. There's another cubic operator, which is compatible with all the symmetries, pi dot times the spatial derivative of pi squared. This operator, or rather an appropriate linear combination of the first two operators, generates what's called the orthogonal FNL parameter. And then we can keep going. I just filled the slide, but I could have kept going by citing more papers. There are technically natural higher derivative three-point shapes involving more derivatives of the Goldstone boson. One can consider four-point functions. Those are also technically natural. They don't generate loop corrections, don't generate three-point functions from the pi to minus pi symmetry. Quasi-single field inflation is kind of a random example, but this model, I think, is particularly nice. One puts in a second field sigma whose mass is of order Hubble, which is kinetically mixed with the inflaton. I'll talk a little bit more about that example later because the phenomenology is interesting. And so there's a correspondence between the coefficients of this general action, the coefficients A, B, C, and so on, and FNL-like parameters that we can search for in the CMB. And the philosophy here is sort of like particle physics, where we just write down all the possible interactions. And in particle physics, you know, an endpoint operator would compute some event rate for a process involving where the total number of input and output particles was n. In cosmology, we can't do scattering experiments. The experiment has only been done once during the Big Bang. But an operator with n powers of the Goldstone boson will show up as some endpoint correlation function in the CMB, some statistical correlation that we can observe afterwards. Okay, so that's my rapid-fire overview of the theory. Next, I'm going to talk about CMB data analysis and the current status from Planck. Conceptually, what we're trying to do when we look for these signals in the CMB is the following. We have some operator that we're interested in, some degree n operator that we've added to the action that we're interested in searching for. And so we work out, first we do the perturbative QFT calculation to work out the curvature endpoint function produced by the operator. And then we think of the CMB as some linear black box that takes the curvature, the adiabatic curvature perturbation, zeta k, that 3D field, and processes it into the 2D CMB that we observe today. So the endpoint correlation function in zeta will just evolve to an endpoint correlation function on the sky. And then there's a CMB estimator that we apply to optimally test statistically for that correlation. I want to just focus on a few aspects of this problem that I think are interesting. So consider, for example, the pi dot cubed interaction. So as I said before, it's straightforward to compute the curvature three-point function. But we get stuck with computational difficulties in the next two steps. If we just want to evolve that simple-looking curvature three-point function to the three-point function of the CMB, then if you work through the algebra, you end up with this horrible set of oscillatory integrals that have to be computed independently for each triple of L's. There's a numerical transfer function here that encodes all the CMB physics that would come out of a program like CMB Fast and CAM. But even with that pre-computed, these integrals are really computationally difficult. And even if you could compute them, then the CMB estimator that you need to apply naively appears to require a number of terms equal to the fifth power of the maximum multipole in the map. So for something like Planck, with Lmax equals 2,000, this would be computationally unaffordable even on a huge computer. So I want to talk about how these computational problems have been solved. And I'm going to present this sort of following the historical sequence of papers. So I'll show you how we kind of stumbled on the answer. And then in the end, the final answer, I think, will be simpler. I'll tell you what we should have realized the answer was in hindsight. OK. So this interesting trick was noticed, that if we just suppose that the curvature three-point function was a factorizable function of the scalar length to the three k's, then if you just plug this factorizable form of the three-point function into the preceding chain of equations, then you find that both the CMB three-point function and the optimal estimator, which tests for the statistical correlation in the map, are fast to evaluate. And so one way to do this data analysis, if you're interested in a particular shape, is to try to approximate your shape by a factorizable template. For this particular example, the pi dot cube shape, it just happens that the strange-looking expression on the second line is an excellent approximation. It's like 99% correlated to the true non-factorizable shape. So that's one option. You can look for factorizable templates. That sometimes works, or factorizable approximation. But another possibility is to find some algebraic magic trick. Like, it turns out that for this, I noticed in a paper with Matias Aldariaga in 2006, if you take this pi dot cube shape, you can write it as an integral. It has this integral representation. And if I just replace that integral by a finite sum, approximate the integral by a finite sum, then I've represented this three-point function as a sum of factorizable terms. Now, what we realized later is that this magic trick was just undoing the last step of the Feynman diagram calculation. When we evaluated this diagram, it was just naturally presented as an integral over conformal time, and that just directly gives the factorizable representation. And the nice thing about this is that it generalizes to any tree diagram. For example, not only can you do all the three-point functions I showed in the previous slide just by going back to the physics, applying the NN formalism, getting the three-point function as an integral over conformal time, but you can generalize this trick easily to more complicated examples like the four-point function, where it's much harder to just find a factorizable approximation, a factorizable template. So this is a really powerful trick that just basically solves the whole computational problem and makes this analysis generally tractable. Just as a fun example to illustrate the power of this method, if you're interested in the so-called resonant model for non-Gaussianity, if you go to, for example, this paper by Payer and Flauger from 2010, if you look at the first line, here's their three-point function. If you're interested, if I just gave you this expression and asked you to find a integral representation that was factorizable, you'd be hard-pressed to do it, but if you just go back to the physics, to the diagram that gives this amplitude, then you can arrive at this factorizable representation in the second line. Although there's some trickery here, you have to choose the right contour deformation. But anyway, this seems to work with perhaps some little trickery for any shape that I personally know of, any physically interesting shape. A really nice way of saying this, which I think is the ultimate generalization of the statistical estimator, is that one can just write down like estimator Feynman rules that go directly from a diagram to an estimator. So if I'm interested in, for example, this pi dot cube diagram on the bottom line, then I can just write down the estimator. If I'm just a blue collar CMB cosmologist and I want to look for this diagram in the CMB, I don't have to go through any calculations. I can just write down a set of Feynman diagrams where I can apply this diagram, if you want, directly to a CMB map. So each external line represents one power of the measured CMB data. Each internal line represents some pre-computed harmonic space factor, which is used to filter the data. And each vertex just involves an integral in real space. So that's a very, very easy way of writing down the optimal estimator for any physical endpoint function that comes from a tree-level QFT calculation. So for a final example, this example of quasi-single field inflation, I'll come back to this in a bit in the large-scale structure part of the talk. Here the inflaton that generates the adiabatic curvature perturbation is kinetically mixed with some second field sigma. One interesting thing about this model is that both the three-point function and the four-point function can be relevant. They depend on different parametric combinations of the coupling constant G and the kinetic mixing rho. And so depending on where you are in this parameter space, either the three-point function or the four-point function can dominate the signal to noise. And so it's important to constrain both, evaluate both of these diagrams. All right. In this slide, I've summarized the current status on the constraints that we reported in the Planck papers. So the blue models are shapes where we've reported a constraint. The red are models where we haven't. Some of these are actually my fault. Some of the red examples are my fault. And in all the blue cases, no deviation from Gaussian statistics is seen. This is sort of a disappointment, at least at Planck's level of sensitivity. We aren't seeing any of these deviations from simplest models of inflation. But I think it's important to say that this analysis is still at an intermediate stage where we've looked for some parameters and not others. Okay. So I'll come back and talk a little bit more about the CMB before the end. But I want to make a few more quick comments before going on to large-scale structure. So where do we stand in the presence of these constraints? Well, it's said in the Planck papers that these non-Gaussianity constraints, we say that they put pressure on certain models. But I think really if you ask from the theorist perspective, what value of F and L would you have to get to before you would start ruling out qualitative classes of models? It's really more like F and L of order one. For example, the modulated reheating model that generates F and L local, or the cyclic model, which is a non-inflationary model, an ekpyrotic model involving multiple fields, allow larger F and L, but are not ruled out by any means by this measurement. Although it is true that there's some volume of parameter space that is reduced, those models are still perfectly fine. There are a few interesting exceptions. For example, DBI inflation is not ruled out by the current Planck constraints, but there's a combination, and DBI produces F and L equilateral, but there's a combination of the tensor scalar ratio R and F and L equilateral, which must be above a certain value in DBI model, in DBI inflation. In other words, you can't have both R and F and L equilateral small at the same time. And so if we improve the limits on R a little bit more, this model could presumably be ruled out, or maybe we can see evidence for it. If we ask, I think what we'd really like to know is whether we'll ever, in the field of cosmology, get to limits on F and L of order one. The answer, as far as I can tell, is probably not in the CMB. Planck is sort of saturating the information from CMB temperature. Polarization can perhaps improve these limits by another root two, or maybe a little more if you can go out to higher L on polarization than temperature before you hit foreground contamination. But there's not room to really improve qualitatively in the CMB. And so if we are looking to the future, I think we have to ask about non-CMB observables. And so in the last part of the talk, I'm going to talk about large-scale structure, what we in the future will be able to say about non-Gaussianity from large-scale structure measurements. I think a really nice picture has emerged in the last few years, and so I just want to summarize what that picture is. So first, just a couple slides of review. In a Gaussian cosmology on large scales, halos linearly trace the matter density. So if we smooth everything, say, on a large enough scale, we would find that the fractional overdensity of halos in a given volume is some multiplier, some constant, the halo bias, times the fractional matter overdensity. This means that if we measure, say, the halo-halo power spectrum by measuring clustering of halos or their luminous tracers, like galaxies or quasars, or if we measure the matter halo power spectrum through some other observation, like galaxy-galaxy lensing, then we're just measuring the same information that's in the matter-matter power spectrum. PMH is just B times PMM, and PHH is B squared times PMM. In 2007, it was realized in this very seminal paper by Neil Dalal et al. That this picture is totally different in a FNL cosmology. So there's a huge clustering effect on large scales in an FNL cosmology. And one way to write it down is to say that the halo bias, B, is no longer a constant, but a function of K that blows up on large scales that has a term proportional to FNL over K squared. So if we measure, say, the matter halo power spectrum or the halo power spectrum, these factors of B of k and B of k squared can produce a large measurable signal at low k or large scales. And the constraints on FNL from the signal ultimately can be better than what we will be able to do in the CMB. So that's the phenomenon. And I want to just kind of offer an intuitive explanation for it before I move on to talk about generalizations. So consider these cartoons that give three equivalent descriptions of an FNL cosmology. What's going on in the first cartoon, is that in an FNL cosmology, if I have a long wavelength mode shown by the dashed black line, then it's modulating the statistics of the small scales. So in a long wavelength over density, say, the small scale power spectrum is larger than it is in a long wavelength under density. In contrast to a Gaussian cosmology, where the short wavelength and the long wavelength modes are statistically independent. An equivalent statement is to say that the three-point function is large in squeezed triangles. This type of correlation shown in the first picture is a correlation between a long wavelength mode and small-scale power, which is a quadratic quantity. And so we're talking about a three-point correlation with one power of the long wavelength mode and two powers of the short wavelength mode, a squeezed triangle. And finally, a three-point function with this particular k dependence is equivalent to the statement that if I locally measure the amplitude of the initial power spectrum, which I'm hardwired when I talk about large-scale structure to call that sigma 8, the locally observed power spectrum amplitude sigma 8, then this would vary from place to place. It's no longer a constant, a constant parameter, but something that varies from place to place in the universe in a way which is proportional to FNL times phi, where phi is the Newtonian potential. So this picture naturally leads to the enhanced large-scale clustering. If we take the third description, then I can say that the halo density from place to place in the universe, as I move from place to place in the universe, two things are different. Background matter density and the locally observed power spectrum amplitude sigma 8. And so I can write the fractional halo density, I can just Taylor expand it if you want, as some parameter B0 times the matter over density, that's just the usual Gaussian bias, plus a term which is proportional to the local value of sigma 8, which in this FNL cosmology is proportional to FNL times phi. And then if I relate phi to the matter over density delta, by Poisson's equation, then phi is rho over k squared. And so it's the k squared in Poisson's equation which gives rise to the 1 over k squared term in the bias. So that's a nice intuitive picture. Now I'm going to talk about a natural question to ask is how does this generalize? So this is just for the simplest non-Gaussian model, the FNL model. How does this generalize to an arbitrary non-Gaussian model, such as the long list I showed on previous slides? So to be really general, let's just parameterize an arbitrary model of the non-Gaussian initial conditions by its connected cumulants. And then see if we can work out what happens to clustering of halos on large scales. So to do this, we take, in this paper with Daniel Bauman, Daniel Green, and Simone Ferraro, we take the following semi-analytic model for halo abundance. Start with the linearly evolved density field, which is just some linear transfer function times the initial curvature perturbation zeta. You smooth that field on some mass scale m. If you can top hat smooth it by a sphere that encloses mass m. And then you just identify, now you have some field, delta m. And you identify the halos as regions where the smooth field delta m exceeds some critical density delta c, which is just a constant often taken to be 1.68 for reasons that aren't particularly important. All right, so the point is, so this is a toy model of halos, which is qualitatively successful in explaining their clustering properties. And so in this model, the halo field is just a completely specified function of the initial curvature zeta, a nonlinear function. And so we could just use a brute force procedure to compute how these clustering power spectra, the matter halo power spectra, we can expand those in the cumulants of the field. So we did that calculation, and I want to just summarize the answer schematically. So we find that the matter halo power spectrum is a sum of terms, where in the nth term, I'm integrating the endpoint correlation function of the initial conditions, broadly integrating it over a bunch of configurations, where one of the scales is set to the scale k, where I measure the matter halo power spectrum. And the other halos are just broadly integrated with some kernel that peaks at the halo, at the Lagrangian halo scale around, five megaparsecs. So this is naturally selecting. This shows that large-scale structure is naturally sensitive to these squeeze limits of endpoint functions. The halo-halo power spectrum contains these squeeze terms. It's a double sum. And in addition, new terms where I integrate an m plus n point function, broadly integrated over with a kernel such that the side lengths of the endpoint functions are peaked at the halo scale. But there is a large scale which is held fixed. The vector sum of m of the k's has to equal the scale where I evaluate the halo-halo power spectrum. So this is naturally selecting the so-called collapse limit of an m plus n point function. Just to go through a few quick examples, which we worked out before finding this general picture, in the GNL model, there's a squeezed endpoint function which is large, this four-point function. And if you plug it into our general formula, you find a scale-dependent bias, which is similar to the FNL model. There's just a new term proportional to 1 over k squared. So this basically gives rise to the same clustering signature as the FNL model. In principle, you can tell the difference, maybe, because the redshift and mass dependence of the new term are different for FNL versus GNL. But in practice, that'll be hard. So this is probably sort of degenerate with FNL. The Tauenel model was interesting. So in the Tauenel model, if the coefficient FNL of the squeezed three-point function and the coefficient Tauenel of the collapsed 2 plus 2-point function, if those are independent parameters, then we get the following expressions for the matter halo and halo-halo power spectrum. So the matter halo power spectrum is the same as in the FNL model. That's just a non-Gaussian bias with a 1 over k squared term times p matter-matter. The halo-halo power spectrum is different. If you just imagine squaring the bias and then replacing the term that was FNL squared by Tauenel, that's the halo-halo power spectrum. And so what's happening in this model is that we have stochastic halo bias, what's called stochastic halo bias, meaning that the matter and halo fields are no longer proportional on large scales. And so that's kind of a unique signature of this Tauenel model. It has some new observational features. For example, you'll infer different bias parameters if you measure the matter halo, halo-halo power spectrum. You'll find that different tracer populations with different biases are not 100% correlated. And even with a single tracer population, there's some scope for inferring that Tauenel for measuring FNL and Tauenel independently, because if you've measured PHH, you can just fit for the coefficients of the 1 over k squared and 1 over k to the fourth terms. All right? And then my final example is going to be quasi-single field inflation, this model where the three-point function and the four-point function had different parametric dependence on parameters. And so what we find here is that, first off, the bias is mostly stochastic. And secondly, that the k dependence is no longer 1 over k squared, but has an exponent. The exponent of k is sensitive to the mass of this mediator field. So in this example, if you can measure this non-Gaussian bias, you could hope to read off the mass of this field. In the limit where the second field is massless, this looks like the local model. I want to conclude with a few general comments. So there's this very nice picture, I think, that large-scale structure is very sensitive to some flavors of non-Gaussianity, but not all, only those which have large squeezed or collapsed limits. Now, it's interesting to compare this statement with theorems, which say that these special limits of endpoint functions are always small in single-field models of inflation. So these theorems are called consistency relations. So the first theorem of this type was proved in this, these early papers by Maldacena and another paper by Carminelli and Zaldarriaga, So suppose that inflation is single field, by which I mean that only fluctuations in only one field are important for setting the adiabatic curvature perturbation at the end of inflation, and that the field which is responsible is the inflaton, the field that dominates the stress energy during inflation. Under those assumptions, the squeeze limit of the three-point function has this universal formula with a proportional to 1 minus ns, the deviation from scale invariance in the power spectrum, which implies, for practical purposes, that FNL is zero using the observed value of ns. FNL is too small, realistically, to ever observe. I realize these sentences on the slide don't explain what's going on here very well, so let me just try to do better in words. So the reason this is true, there's kind of this physical argument that in single field inflation, the only physical clock is the field value of the inflaton. When we talk about a squeezed triangle like this, well, we're asking for the correlation between a long wavelength mode that exited the horizon very early and two powers of a short wavelength mode. So we're asking what effect a long wavelength fluctuation has on the subsequent power spectrum of a short wavelength mode. Now, you might think that there's no effect because of the statement that the inflaton is the only clock. What that means is that at a given value, once the long wavelength mode exits the horizon, we just go right back to the attractor solution. At a given value of phi, physically observed quantities like phi dot, h, and so on have to be the same. And so the short wavelength mode, you would think, wouldn't care whether there was a long wavelength perturbation in the first place. And that's physically true, but there's one little loophole, which is that the thing that can be different is the coordinate transformation that relates global coordinates to physical coordinates in the long wavelength overdense or underdense region. If there's a coordinate transformation between those two coordinate systems varies on long wavelengths, then a super observer that computes the three-point function in global coordinates will see some small non-zero value that just arises because the power spectrum isn't perfectly scale invariant. So if you compute it in rescaled coordinates, you think that you get a different value, but it's really more of a coordinate artifact than anything physical. For purposes of talking about phenomenology, this single field consistency relation is just saying that this squeezed three-point function has to be too small to generate in single field inflation to generate any observable signal. And this has actually been generalized to other endpoint configurations, precisely the same configurations that large-scale structure is sensitive to. So it's been shown just generally that all squeezed endpoint functions and all collapsed m plus n point limits are similarly small in single field inflation. So one can make the general statement that large-scale clustering is a very sensitive probe of multi-field inflation, which generates signals like FNL local, but is just insensitive to single field inflation, to self-interactions of a single inflaton field. All right. Some more comments on these squeeze and collapse limits. You can also interpret them as, if you have a large squeezed or collapsed limit, you can interpret that as saying that the universe is no longer statistically homogeneous on large scales, but there's some change in the small scale statistics that varies from place to place. We saw an example of that when I was drawing cartoons for the FNL model. In an FNL cosmology, an observer that measures their locally observed power spectrum amplitude sigma 8, we'll see different values of sigma 8 in different parts of the universe in a way that's 100% correlated with the long wavelength mode. Just to give some more examples, if I had, say, this collapsed four-point function, if that's large, what that means is that an observer that measures local skewness, just looking at a small region, will see different skewnesses from place to place, and the locally observed skewness will be 100% correlated with the long wavelength mode. This collapsed two-point function, 2 plus two-point function, means that sigma 8 varies from place to place, in a way which is not necessarily correlated with anything else. It's just some stochastic variation that doesn't care about the long wavelength density field or the long wavelength phi field. So this interpretation is actually a very powerful way to think about things. We wrote this sort of amusing paper in 2011. So there's this statement called the Sugiyama-Yamaguchi inequality, which says that this the parameters tau and L and F and L have to satisfy this inequality, where one can define these parameters for an arbitrary non-Gaussian model by appropriate limits of the squeezed three-point function and collapsed 2 plus 2-point function. Doesn't necessarily have to be the local model. It could. The definition is more general. In 2011, the situation was that this inequality was conjectured to be generally true, and it was proven in special cases. Like, there was a paper that proved a weaker version of the inequality up to two loops. But there's a very trivial proof as follows. If you think of the squeezed three-point function as measuring the cross power of the density field delta and an auxiliary field sigma, which is just defined to be the local power spectrum amplitude that a local observer sees. So if you think of F and L as measuring the large-scale cross power between delta and sigma, and you think of tau and L as measuring the large-scale auto power of sigma, then there's an obvious positivity condition that says that if sigma is highly correlated with delta, then there's some minimum amount of power that the field sigma has to have. Its power spectrum can't be zero, for example, if it's correlated with something else. And a more formal way of presenting this is that if we just compute the correlation coefficient R between these two fields, sigma and zeta on large scales, then the inequality is just a statement that this correlation coefficient has to be between minus 1 and 1. This proof is just a couple paragraphs long, but it just sort of shows the power of this physical interpretation of these special limits. So in summary, primordial non-Gaussianity is a very multifaceted field because we can perturb the physics of the simplest models of inflation in many different ways. This leads to many different observables to look for. I hope I've managed to do justice to the physics and sort of categorize things a bit. The CMB is sort of ideal from a data analysis perspective. We can measure all endpoint correlation functions of the CMB independently with full shape discrimination. The mantra here is that there's sort of one for every diagram we can draw that generates a physical signal, we can write down an independent estimator. So far, Planck is consistent with Gaussian statistics, but we're kind of at the midpoint of the analysis, so the statement isn't fully exhaustive yet. In large-scale structure, I think we have we've recently arrived at a very good theoretical understanding of what we can and cannot expect to see or be sensitive to. So future constraints should eventually be at the CMB, but only for models with large squeeze and collapse limits. Single field consistency theorems imply that these models have to be multi-field. Large-scale structure is trickier than the CMB in that the large-scale clustering signal is not only an integral over many configurations of the endpoint functions, but even summed over different values of n. So you can't even, not only do you not have shape discrimination, but say the FNL model, which is a three-point signal, is degenerate with the GNL model, a four-point signal, and you're not even discriminating different values of n. But there is some scope for differentiating models. For example, the quasi-single field model has a non-trivial k dependence of the halo bias. You can read off a mass from that. And some models generate stochastic bias, whereas others are non-stochastic. These seem to be the main two pieces of information that one would get from large-scale structure measurements. That's all I have to say. Thanks.
You want to comment?
The inequality you are talking about is actually by Suyama and Yamaguchi, not Sugiyama.
Sorry?
It's by Suyama and Yamaguchi.
Yes, yes. Oh, sorry. I did know that. That's a typo.
Okay. Questions? Go here first.
Hi. Yeah, this was just a quick question. I mean, your Feynman rules way of working out what the estimator should be. Where did the transfer function appear?
Sorry, say that again?
Just in the middle part of the talk where we were looking at the Feynman rules, the estimator. I was just curious where the transfer function appeared.
It's hidden in the
propagator,
Feynman rule for the internal line.
The internal line, yeah.
The external line.
The
transfer function would be in the...
That's right, and you had this numerically, so then you just work out this...
Say that again?
So you had the transfer function which you computed numerically, and then that's...
The Feynman rule for the external line would involve this pre-computed harmonic space vector, and that's an integral involving Bessel function.
But you computed it once off, as it were, so then it just sits there in the external layer.
That's right. Yeah.
So at the beginning, in your theory side of the presentation, you had some interactions with free derivatives per scalar?
Yes.
And I wonder, do you have a symmetry in order to kill the guys with two derivatives and some reason to kill the guys with four derivatives? Or, I mean, how does interaction comes about?
So this is work in progress with Mirdad Mirbiabi, Siavash Bebani, and Leonardo Santori. I don't know a good short way of summarizing it, but we can talk about it maybe afterwards. Part of the analysis is figuring out which higher derivative three-point interactions are technically natural. In other words, don't generate larger interactions with fewer derivatives via loop corrections. And then part of the analysis is figuring out which linear combinations of those operators generate CMB three-point functions which are not highly correlated to the existing shapes so that they can evade limits from FNL equilateral and FNL orthogonal. So when we combine both of those analyses, we're left with two possibilities.
Okay.
It's a related question to this. So you showed this resonant non-Gaussianity example, right?
Oh, yes.
So this is really exciting. So have you actually managed to build an estimator for this? And what frequency can you go to in delta L?
The number of terms in the factorizable representation here is proportional to just the number of oscillations, the total number of oscillations in the observed range of multiples in the CMB. This just becomes more and more expensive in the limit of a rapidly oscillating signal. So I would guess based on other examples. The story here is that I sort of figured out that this factorizable representation would work. But then there was a paper by Senatori and collaborators arguing that for this model, there was no part of parameter space where the three-point function had larger signal noise than the two-point function, and the theory was also under perturbative control. Then there's a follow-up paper by Daniel Green finding a way around that. So I haven't. I had sort of put this on the back burner and never took it off after Dan's paper. I went as far with this as figuring out that the factorizable representation would work. It gets more expensive as you increase the oscillation frequency to actually find the place where it would really become too expensive. It's just a computational limit. I would need to go a little bit farther and actually do some follow-up steps. There's an optimization algorithm that we run to optimize the number of terms in the factorizable representation. But I would sort of guess that you could go up to like order 10 or so oscillations per log k. It's probably doable.
Okay. I'll show you an example on Wednesday which might motivate you to do that.
Okay. Cool.
Any further questions? Can you pick up the mic sitting next to you and turn it on? Thanks.
Yes. So
It's a question about the large-scale structure case. So
yes.
There are models of primordial Lagrangianity in which in the squeezed limit you have some extra angular dependence.
Oh, right, okay.
And so my question is, can you envisage any observable for large-scale structures which is going to be sensitive to that kind of squeezed limit?
Oh, that's an interesting question that I just have not thought about. So let me try to answer off the top of my head. So there, I think what's going to happen is that you have some variation in the small-scale statistics, which is correlated with phi, but in such a way that the average power spectrum doesn't change; it just gets a quadrupolar distortion.
Correct.
Right, and so that would not, to first order in the distortion, that's not going to change halo abundance. Because halo abundance is a scalar quantity. But there are probably other things that are different. You're going to get like tidal fields. So maybe redshift space distortions would get a large signal at low k for redshift space distortions. Or if you look at some non-scalar quantity, which is which would directly be sensitive to a anisotropic power spectrum, like say Lyman alpha forest, or I don't know, if you had a 21 centimeter map that was just measuring all the modes, all the small scale modes, you could compute the quadrupolar part of the power spectrum. So I think large scale structure should, in principle, be quite sensitive to the type of model that you're talking about, but not via this particular statistic.
So large scale structure is indeed promising, but with lots of pitfalls. So I wonder if you could talk about the experiments, surveys that might give us the best option, the controllability of the very large scale systematic effects, not the least of which is a selection function. What I think is might be very interesting, you probably have thoughts on, which is the use of cross correlations to try and beat down the uncertainties biasing.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah, that's a great question. This large scale signal, from a theorist point of view, it has the nice property that it's sort of protected from astrophysical systematics. If we go out to high K, then nonlinear effects enter the power spectrum, but it's harder to subtract off the Gaussian contribution. But in the limit of low K, everything's very well understood. Astrophysical proper processes that move matter around through a finite distance, preserving stress energy, can't change the power spectrum at low K the way that FNL can. So this is maximally easy from the point of view of protecting yourself from astrophysical systematics, but I think maximally hard from the point of view of instrumental systematics. Large-scale calibration is notoriously difficult. In an experiment that takes, where you're measuring, say, the abundance of galaxies in a big region, you're assembling it together from exposures taken at different times, say, on different nights, when the seeing is different, quantities like air mass are different. You're looking through different dust opacities in different parts of the sky. If there's some instrumental dependence on the observed number dependence in different parts of the sky, then that just looks like large-scale power and can be degenerate with adding extra large-scale power via primordial non-Gaussianity. So one way around that, as you say, is to use cross-correlations. There was a really nice paper just before Planck by Tommaso Gianantonio, obtaining limits on FNL by taking a bunch of large-scale structure experiments, which each independently have instrumental large-scale power, that would be a problem for measuring FNL. But if you cross-correlate them, if you take appropriate cross-correlations, then you can remove that excess power. For example, if I cross-correlate, say, luminous red galaxies in SDSS, which have spurious large-scale power from dust extinction. If I cross-correlate that with a radio galaxy sample, say NBSS, where dust isn't a factor, NBSS has its own systematic problems, but the systematics are not correlated. So if I compute the cross-power spectrum of those two surveys, the systematic power goes away, and I can cleanly see this effect. So cross-correlation is one strategy. You know, the other strategy is to try to just characterize, just design an experiment very carefully to have excellent calibration on large scales and just try to control the systematics. There was there's a Sloan constraint from high redshift photometric quasars from a few years ago that managed to do that. In terms of how we'll, obviously this is going to get harder and harder, beating these systematics is going to get harder and harder as we try to go to smaller values of FNL. In terms of what's realistic and whether we'll get to, for example, statistical error of one in LSST, I think we'll just have to wait and see.
Let's thank Hendrik again.